Money, Riches, and Wealth is sponsored by the Financial Consulate. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your hosts, Drew Tignanelli and Tim Maurer.
And this is Drew Tignanelli here with Money, Riches, and Wealth, and TJ is in the house.
As always, well, not as always, but as often.
What were you doing at CNBC last week? Well, I told him you were going, and then I said, but to be honest with you, I don't have any idea what
you didn't
he was
remember.
Going.
Or, yeah, man, I even shared it with you. So I was working with Sharon Epperson.
You shared
Epperson.
It with me, but I forgot.
I was working with Sharon Epperson, who is, you know, one of my favorite reporters out there, period. And what we had was a panel of three financial advisors. CNBC is actually doing more in their kind of personal finance realm, and we were actually taping eight different segments that are going to be running on their programming as well as online, directly discussing personal finance issues. So that was right down my alley, Drew.
Yeah, that sounds like a good time.
Really enjoyed it.
And tonight, Drew's View, I just want to address something real quick. Well, it's not real quick, but it's quick. And that is, I've heard that, you know, there's other financial talk shows out there that have been talking.
I've heard that true.
That have been talking. I can't believe it, but there are.
Yeah, it's hard to
believe. That have been talking about that, you know, even if your income's too high, you can do a non-deductible IRA. You can do a non-deductible traditional IRA.
Correct.
And then convert it to a Roth and get around the fact that you have too much in income.
Correct.
Well,
this is partly true, right?
There is a truth to this, and we do it all the time.
Yes.
But as they say in some of those, like Evel Knievel, you know, what you're seeing here and what you're hearing here.
Don't try this at home
unless you know what you're doing and why you're doing it and how it works. There are three big issues.
Okay.
Number one, if you do a non-deductible IRA, the very first thing, and you intend to convert it to a Roth, the very first thing is you cannot have any other traditional IRAs in place if you expect to do it tax-free. There
Correct.
Are a lot of people who think I can just put $5,000 into a Fidelity account. All my other IRAs are over here at Schwab, let's say.
Right.
And then at the end of the year, I'll just convert my Fidelity non-deductible IRA over to a Roth and do it tax-free.
Simple.
And it doesn't work. There's a pro rata rule that you have to know and understand how it operates. The second thing is you've got to make sure that even if you don't have any IRAs, you make sure you don't roll over any IRAs like you have an old 401k. And in December, you just say, hey, I'm going to roll this to my IRA. Well, if you do that in the year you did this conversion, you cause the problem again. It's the pro rata rule.
The pro rata rule blows up.
Next thing you need to do is you need to make sure you always have your accountant properly fill out an 8606 tax form stating what your tax deductible, your tax-free basis is in the IRA.
Sure.
And it has to be maintained and proper reporting when it's converted, et cetera, to make sure you get your tax-free status.
Sure.
And I see that 8606 missing so often. And then lastly, you should never – now, there's nothing against this in the law, and there's no court cases to say – but in my opinion, you should never put money into a non-deductible IRA and then a day later convert it to a Roth. To me, that is an absolute no-no if you don't want to get slapped on the wrist by the IRS and lose some benefits. What I always do is I put the money into a non-deductible IRA. I wait until, like if I did it for 2013, I will not convert that non-deductible IRA until April 20th of 2014, after the last day that somebody can either withdraw an IRA, after somebody can withdraw an IRA contribution without penalty as an excess. So if I put an excess contribution in now for 2013 and I withdraw it before April 15, 2014, it would not be counted against me as an excess contribution because I got it out in time.
Right.
Therefore, you should never convert and assume that the IRS is going to assume that it was a 2013 traditional non-deductible IRA. Anyway, tell us, we've got somebody online from Budapest.
I know.
I've been there. I called in once to this show from Budapest about 15 years ago. Yeah, 1994. Anyway, go ahead.
Tonight we have with us, Drew, Adam Labor. He's an author, journalist, and literary critic based in Budapest. He writes for The Economist, The Times in London, Monocle, and numerous other publications, and also reviews books for The New York Times. He has been a foreign correspondent since 1991, covering the collapse of communism and the Yugoslav wars, and has worked in more than 30 different countries. He is the author of 7 critically acclaimed nonfiction books, including the groundbreaking Hitler's Secret Bankers and 2 novels. He'll be with us tonight discussing his newest book, Tower of Basel, The Shadowy History of the Secret Bank That Runs the World. Adam, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Hey, Adam, you know, the reason we wanted to meet with you, you know, or talk with you about your latest book, Tower of Basel, is because most of our listeners probably don't even know that this entity exists, and yet they understand to some degree that the Federal Reserve is extremely powerful and can really impact their investments, but most people don't understand that this organization actually influences the Federal Reserve.
Yes, most people have never heard of the Bank for International Settlements. I would say it's the most important bank in the world that you've never heard of.
Yeah.
The BIS, it was founded in 1930 as the Bank for Central Banks. And the most important thing about it nowadays is that every 2 months, the 60 most powerful central bankers in the world, such as Ben Bernanke and Mark Carney from the Bank of England and Mario Draghi from the European Central Bank, all meet there to talk about monetary policy. And these meetings are secret because we don't know who actually attends. We know who is allowed to attend, but we don't know what they talk about, and we don't know what they discuss, and we don't know what the result of these discussions are, even though all the central bankers and the people from the Fed, for example, are public servants.
So what I wanted to address first is, you know, as an investor, you really have to pay attention to history.
Mm-hmm.
So what I want to start, Adam, is get a little bit of the background of the history of the Bank for International Settlements, BIS, as we're going to call it throughout this show, because that's an important starting point. Before we get back to the later part of this show, we're going to talk about what does that mean for you today. So why don't you tell us just a little bit about the history? We got to take a break in about a minute, so just give us a quick, and then we'll come back and do some more.
Yeah, the BIS was founded in 1930. It was founded as part of the Young Plan, which was an American-driven plan to manage German reparations for the First World War, the money that Germany was penalized for its role in the First World War. And there were all sorts of different plans, and eventually the Young Plan was released. Was agreed, and they agreed that if Germany was going to pay these reparations, they should set up a new bank to manage that, and that was called the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements. But the real reason the BIS was set up was as a bank for central banks and as a place for central bankers to meet.
Without the political influence.
That's it precisely. I mean, one of the key things about the BIS was that it's completely independent of any government. And in fact, the first president was an American banker called Gates McGarra. And he was very proudly said the BIS is beyond the influence of any government. And it was founded by an international treaty, which means that it's inviolable. Its assets can never be seized, even in times of war. And the premises, which is still in Basel now, although it's not in the same building as it originally was, the Swiss authorities have to get the permission of the bank's management to enter it. So it's this kind of strange hybrid because it's a bank, a very profitable bank, but it has similar protections to a diplomatic embassy or the United Nations, for example.
All right, Adam, you got to hold on with us. We're going to take a break real quick, and we're going to come back, talk more about this. Right now, we got to go to Terry Trey and traffic and be right back. Money, Rich, and Wealth.
Talk Radio 680, WCPN.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
You can tell that Noah's not here.
That's correct.
And
because
Kristen,
he played a really good song.
Kristen
is wonderful.
But she didn't have a banker song.
She didn't have a banker song. But, you know, it would have been difficult for Noah to find a good banker song. We may have had one of those things like some dude sitting on his bed with a guitar in YouTube saying something about a
Noah's
central bank.
Right? Noah's good with that, isn't he?
He is good with that. And so Kristen, our esteemed producer tonight, we're so glad to have you with us.
Anyway, Adam, let's talk more about the history of the BIS. This bank was actually formed in the 1930s, as you said, but it actually had a profit motive. So how do they make money?
It makes money by providing banking services to its customers. It has around 140 customers.
And that's not like you or me.
No, they're only central banks. They're almost all central banks, and it says one or two international organizations as well also bank with the BIS. Now, everybody wants to bank with the BIS because if it handles your investments, then you do very well because it's got like a AAA platinum rating. It's very highly regarded. But the bank, like all banks or all Swiss banks really, especially, is quite secretive, and it won't say who those international organizations are. But when I was researching my book, I did find some material in the archives which showed that the BIS was doing some work for the International Committee of the Red Cross during the Second World War. So I think you can guess that they're probably still acting as their bankers now, especially if the Red Cross is also in Switzerland. But the BIS provides services for the central banks, especially central banks, smaller central banks. You know, say if you're from a country like, say, Macedonia or Ghana, perhaps, you know, from the developing world, you don't have such sophisticated skills in managing assets and in terms of central banking skills. So you go to the BIS and they'll do things for you. They'll do asset management and they'll do gold swaps for you, swapping currency for gold and swapping it back again as you need it, and providing short-term credit. I mean, the BIS
sort of like outsourcing.
Bailouts.
Sort of like outsourcing for central bankers. If we ever need to outsource our central banking, Tim, we can go to the BIS.
Go to the Tower of Basel.
Yeah, you'll know where to go.
and you know, another thing, too, is if you have a conflict with another nation, and this is part of their history, you go to the BIS instead of going them to directly, because during World War II, the BIS basically was the banker for all the people who were fighting each other.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this was the most fascinating material that I found. And I'll give credit to the BIS. Their archives are open to researchers under the 30-year rule. Any document that's less than 30, or rather, you know, at least 30 years old, is available, apart from some, you know, personal stuff about personnel files or whatever. And I just found a treasure trove of material. I mean, during the Second World War, the BIS had an American president, a banker called Thomas McKittrick. And even after America entered the war in December 1941, McKittrick stayed there. He stayed there until June 1946. And he was running the BIS, and the BIS was providing all sorts of services to Nazi Germany. It was doing foreign exchange deals. It accepted looted Nazi gold, even when McKittrick was specifically warned not to accept this gold, particularly from Belgium.
And Germany... Germany was actually paying its interest on its repatriation debt from World War One during that time.
Well, not exactly, but that's almost right. I mean, it is quite complicated. What happened was in the 1930s, the BIS made loans to Germany and made investments in Germany. And after the war started, you know, you'd think that, you know, the world is at war, so who's going to bother, you know, honoring their financial obligations?
Sure.
You know, you've got a war to fight. But nonetheless, Germany, because it regarded the BIS as very important for it, it was almost like the Reichsbank, the Nazi central bank's window on the world. So it wanted to keep it in business, so it kept paying the interest payments that were due on the BIS's investments.
Uh-huh.
Now, the BIS kept, during the war, continued paying out dividends to its shareholders. Now, its shareholders included the Bank of England. So that means that through this Second World War, Germany, through the BIS, was sending money to Britain. And all sides, it's an incredible story. In this bank, with an American manager and a German deputy manager, under him a guy called Paul Hechler, who was a Nazi party member, and a Frenchman called Roger Aubois, and an Italian called Raphael Pilotti, and a Briton. They all worked together in sort of perfect harmony, really, in nice, safe Basel, which is right on the border with France and Germany, just really a few hundred yards away. Allied troops were, you know, shooting and killing each other. But at the BIS, it was business as usual all through the Second World War. And the interesting thing is that all sides wanted that to be the case. Britain wanted the BIS to stay in business. Berlin wanted it to stay in business. The State Department wanted the BIS to stay in business. The only ones, or some of the most powerful ones, that didn't want the BIS to stay in business was Henry Morgenthau, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, and his senior official, Harry Dexter White, who regarded the BIS as basically, you know, a pro-Nazi operation, even though it was being run by an American banker, Thomas McKittrick.
Well, and Adam, isn't that one of the things that to this day continues to remain a stain or a cloud over the BIS, that they did cooperate with Nazi Germany, effectively laundering the money that they needed to use for their operations?
Yes, absolutely. It was a major cloud on the BIS's history. And it's also an extraordinary story about, you know, sections of the American government and the American establishment, because Thomas McKittrick wasn't running the BIS with all its friendly links with Nazi Germany as some kind of lone agent or some kind of rogue, you know, person doing a rogue operation. He was very close friends with Alan Dulles, the American spy master, who was running the Office for Strategic Services, the precursor of the CIA in Bern. He was known as codename 644 in the OSS documents, and he was supplying information to Alan Dulles. And I found some other documents as well, which said that with the full knowledge of the State Department in early 1945, Thomas McKittrick was arranging deals behind the scenes with Nazi industrialists to say, look, basically, you know, behave, guys, when we come into Germany, and we'll guarantee your profits.
Mm.
So it shows the deep cynicism of governments that even when they're fighting a war against a country, behind the scenes, part of that same government is actually sorting out the money and making the plans for when the war's over to get the profits moving again.
Wow.
So it wasn't the BIS also kind of like a safe haven for some central banks when they feel that, you know, they could have been overrun by another nation, that they would keep their gold and so forth there so that it wouldn't get looted?
Yes, I mean, and that was a mistake, at least in the 1930s and the 1940s. I mean, the most notorious example of that was in 1939. The Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia in March 1939, and before that, the Czechs had sent all their gold to the Bank of England in two tranches. Now, one section, one part of it, about 23 tons, was deposited in a sub-account, in a Czechoslovak National Bank sub-account at the BIS at the Bank of England. And the other part was deposited in the Czechoslovak National Bank's own account at the Bank of England. Now, when the Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia, like the next day or the day after, they marched over to the Czech National Bank, held the director at gunpoint, and said, you send an order to the BIS and the Bank of England transferring all of that gold to the Reichsbank account because Czechoslovakia doesn't exist anymore. You're part of the Reich. We want your gold. And so the directors did that, but they assumed that when this order arrived, it would never be implemented because it's obvious that it was done under duress because Nazi Germany just invaded. But such was the importance at the BIS and at the Bank of England, especially a man called Montague Norman, the governor of the Bank of England. And remember, this is March 1939, when everyone knows Britain is going to go to war with Germany in a few months. They don't know exactly when then, but they know it's, you know, almost certainly going to happen. He ordered that the transfer take place. So Nazi Germany took possession of 23 tons of gold with the help of the Bank of England and the BIS without a shot being fired.
Hmm.
I should add that the second order, which said send the money from the Czechoslovak National Bank's own account, not the BIS sub-account, to Germany, didn't go through, partly because there was such an uproar in Britain.
Hmm.
You know, you can imagine Britain was preparing for war. Even Winston Churchill said in Parliament, how on earth can the government ask men to sign up for the draft to risk their lives to fight Nazi Germany when it's just given the country 23 tons of gold? it shows you how, you know, war is one thing, but money is something else completely.
Mm. Mm.
Well, that was at a time that their prime minister still wanted to try to say peace, you know, until Poland was invaded, 3 months later?
Well, this was in March, and the war started in September. I mean, yes, there was still some appeasers, and I think you could definitely count Montague Norman, the governor of the Bank of England, who was one of the founders of the BIS, as one of those appeasers. But by then it was quite clear. It was just that, you know, Germany had annexed Austria, Germany had annexed the Sudetenland, Germany had invaded the Czech Republic, the Czechoslovakia. It was pretty clear that the war was coming. And
right.
It would have been very easy for Montague Norman and the BIS to say, that bankers, when they want to be, can be very bureaucratic and difficult. So,
right.
Sorry.
That is true.
Well, we can't do that at the moment. You know, we need to take a look at this. You know,
that's
like,
right. Could you sign that card again?
The war's over.
Can we send that card out to you again to sign?
Yeah.
Hold on with us, Adam. We got to take another shot at the traffic and see what's going on out there. Terry, why don't you take it away? We'll be right back. Money, riches, and wealth.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
I can't hear. Oh, there I go. I can hear now. All right. So,
Kristen's working on that. She got the business content here. This is a very business-focused song.
Very.
Drew, I'd like to remind folks that tonight we have with us Adam Labore, wrote a new book, Tower of Basel, that we're discussing.
I think Kristen plays that any longer. We're going to owe money.
Kristen, you have to work with Drew. It's not just that. It's not this, just that he doesn't necessarily appreciate good music. It's almost that he's opposed to it. It's really hard to explain. He's a really nice guy.
Red Rubber Ball.
Red Rubber. He's got 5 songs. We'll talk about it later. But yes, Adam, we appreciate you being with us tonight. And I've got to tell you, as I was preparing for the show, I got stuck in your biographical information. You grew up in London. Effectively, it looks like you became a sort of war correspondent, moving all over the place. And then when you had the chance, I guess, to choose where to put your roots down, you went back to Budapest. How does that come to be?
Well, it's a good question. I always wanted to be a foreign correspondent. Well, I always wanted to be a journalist. And then after I'd been a home news reporter for a while, or what you call on the national desk, I decided I wanted to be a foreign correspondent. So I just walked over to the foreign editor in 1991 and said, I think I want to go abroad. What have you got? And he said, well, we need someone in Budapest. Are you interested?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, yeah, that sounds good because, you know, it's not too far away. It's only a couple of hours. If it all goes horribly wrong, I can just, you know, go back home and probably no one's noticed that I've been away yet. But there you are, you know, 20 years on, I'm still here.
Are you in Buda or are you in Pesh?
I'm in Pesh.
There you go.
Pesh. Buda is boring. It's just hills and houses.
Well, there you go.
Where the action is.
There you go.
You know, Adam, the title of the book, Tower of Basel, there seems to be an obvious parallel here. Are you making a biblical prophecy of sorts regarding the work of this bank?
I think it's not a prophecy, but it's definitely an allusion, or a reference. I mean, it's, of course, to the Tower of Babel. Mm-hmm. And I think the Tower of Babel, you know, if you read that story in the Bible, it's a very interesting example of hubris. You know, they just built and built and built and built and built as high as they could go, and then it all kind of went horribly wrong, because of the arrogance of the builders. So, you know, that's a kind of reference that I wanted to make, because the Bank for International Settlements is quite an unaccountable and, I think, a quite elitist institution. You know, so I wanted to make that reference. And also, you know, it's like people get it, like you got it immediately, Tower of Babel,
sure.
Tower of Basel. People, you know, it's quite snappy, good title.
Good headline, right?
So, Adam, the current bank now, okay, BIS, and we're going into the current time now. What does this mean to people today? And the BIS is becoming kind of backstage to the IMF in many ways, that when there are problems, you know, the BIS comes out and says what they think people are doing wrong, But it's really the IMF that when they come out and say something, it comes with a lot more weight. Is that true?
In a way it is, yeah, in public, because the IMF is the one that's organizing bailouts. For example, you know, in places like Greece or Spain or Portugal, the IMF is the one that's saying much more, together with the European Union or the European Central Bank, saying you can borrow this much, but you're going to have to do this. And the BIS doesn't have that power. The BIS is much more behind the scenes. But its influence is not really so much as a bank, although it's a very profitable bank. Its influence is as a meeting place and as a talking shop. And that happens through different things. As I mentioned at the beginning, every other month there's something called the Global Economy Meeting, where 60 central bankers meet. And they discuss, you know, the state of the global economy and monetary policy and how things are looking and what should be done and what kind of options there are for dealing with it. Now, I had a very good interview with Sir Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England. He's a very influential person at the BIS and outside it as well. And he said these meetings are extremely important because, you know, they were discussing, we're in an unprecedented situation. In lots of countries, there's very low interest rates, there's quantitative easing going on, pumping money into the economy. Is it working? Is it not working? And these forums were the place where this was discussed. But at the same time, a lot of other important things happen at the BIS. The BIS hosts something called the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. Now, this is the committee that regulates commercial banks, like the banks, you know, on Main Street in America, banks where you or I might have our accounts. And this is the committee that sets the 8% rule broadly. I mean, it's incredibly complicated, the various levels of the Basel 1, 2, 3. But broadly, what we need to understand is that they're the ones that set the 8% rule, where if you're lending out $100,000, you have to have $8,000, you know, ready in cash available to get hold of. Now, the Basel Committee doesn't have statutory or legal powers, but it has enormous moral powers. If you want to be a bank that trades in the world, you have to stick to the 8% rule. Now, BIS also hosts something called the Financial Stability Board, which is probably even more obscure than the BIS. It is actually very important because it's a new body, it's a comparatively new body, but it's coordinating regulatory authorities and also the world's central banks to try and get their policies more harmonized to, you know, prevent things such as happened in 2007 and 2008 with the subprime meltdown. So behind the scenes, the BIS is enormously influential as a hosting place.
Right.
Wait a minute.
We're gonna have to take a break here real quick. But a lot of banks are fighting over those safeguards that the BIS is trying to implement to safeguard the banking system. A lot of banks are saying, no, you're going to hurt our profitability. We don't want to do that.
Yes, I mean, it's of course, because, I mean, if you imagine, you know, how disparate and complicated and different the global commercial financial system is, how many different banks are in there and their own conditions and their own, aims and the different factors that affect their policy making. So to have a kind of central plank that they all have to stick to is going to be complicated. And the banks are saying, you know, there's an argument that, you know, the higher the reserve, the more, you know, the more money that you send the banks have to have in reserve, the less there is to lend out. So that can, you know, they say that slows down economic growth and, you know, keeps us in recession because they have to hold this 8% back all the time. But the others say, well, hold on a minute, because banks go bust sometimes and things go obviously wrong, as we've seen, especially in America in the last few years. So, you know, we actually think it should be more than 8% to keep the customer safe. So there's always that tension going on. But, I mean, the debate is happening and 8% is more or less agreed. I mean, there's different ways that 8% is broken down, but it's very complicated and technical.
All right, Adam, you got to hold on with us. TJ is going to tell us something that we need to know, and then we're going to go on a break for a second or two. We're going to come back, finish up with our interview. Hold on, Adam. Go ahead, TJ.
Thank you, Drew. And, Drew, I want you to pay special attention to this one tonight, okay?
All right.
You need to know how music can save your marriage and financial plan. My brother John and I have a recurring argument with our lovely wives, Amanda and Andrea, respectively. They believe that good music is in the ear, as it were, of the beholder. John and I believe that there is objectively good music and bad music, and we refuse to suffer the latter. These little spats are just for fun, usually, and give our lives together a unique texture. But too much variability in the ways we live and love isn't enjoyable, and too often leads to a requiem for our marriages. Discord over financial issues is often cited as the leading cause of divorce, and while the statistical jury is still out on whether money issues are a leading or lagging indicator of marital health, it's clearly an issue worthy of our attention. Here are three ways that you can apply musical theory to maintaining financial harmony in your household. First, establish a rhythm. In music, the rhythm is the foundation of a song. Musicians establish a song's rhythm first through the time signature, musical math composed of measures and beats per measure. Every household has a rhythm of cash flows. Money comes in via income and goes out as expenses. Regulating this rhythm to the best of our abilities allows our household to settle into a comfortable financial pattern. Second, create a melody. Rhythm makes a good song work, but it's the melody that makes it memorable. Financially speaking, we create a melody in choosing how to spend our excess cash flow. Maybe you're known for generous hospitality, like one friend of mine whose parties are not to be missed. Maybe you're making a concerted effort to provide meaningful support to a worthy charity, or broadening your children's horizons through a regular travel. Or maybe you're foregoing income to invest your time as a mentor or even student. Finally, we need to manage dissonance. Dissonance is the sound produced when two or more musical notes don't appear to mesh well. Musically speaking, dissonance can be used to good effect, creating atonal suspense that is eventually resolved. But left unresolved, it's likely a song that no one wants to hear. Financially speaking, every couple is born in dissonance. Our individual personalities, strengths, and weaknesses, compounded by our personal history with money, make it impossible to strike a rich major chord every time. Our goal should be to recognize the dissonance when it arises, treating it not as failure or a misplayed note in our duet, but instead as an opportunity to work toward a deep resonance when the dissonance is resolved. And that is something you need to know.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
It's good. It's a call for calm, right? Absolutely, Kristen. I totally get it, whether Drew does or not. And I love the chairman of the board.
You know, how can you not like Frankie? But anyway, it's, you know, where's Noah?
Oh, Drew. Drew.
No, I've always... Kristen knows I'm only teasing with her because I've always said Kristen has done a great job.
Flawless tonight, too, I might add. Flawless.
And I've helped her before, too. What did we do? You,
Drew,
Benjamin Franklin, right? Yeah. And grandson or something like that. Anyway.
Well, that
so
nice
you had a question.
Well... I did. Okay, so Adam, you...
Did you forget it?
No, I didn't forget it, Drew.
Go ahead.
Let me remind you, we're talking with Adam Labor tonight. He wrote the book The Tower of Basel, among many others.
What time of night is it in Budapest?
That's a good question, Adam.
It's 1 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, so don't keep him up.
Well,
thank you
for joining us. But I'm going to ask you the toughest question of the night, okay? You do commentary on books for the New York Times. They wrote a review of your book that was really quite favorable. There was one thing that caught me in here, and I'm sure it caught you too, and I'll quote it here for you so I make sure I get it right. Today, quote, the BIS is less the secret bank that runs the world, as Labor's conspiratorial-sounding subtitle has it, than a clubby meeting place for central bankers, unquote. Why don't you stand up to that or clarify it to some degree?
Well, my argument is that behind the scenes, since it's been founded in the 1930s, the BIS has played a very important role. It is a meeting place, but it's more than that. I mean, if we go back to the beginning of the bank, when we talked about it being set up, I mean, the BIS was the first place, you know, it's older than the IMF, it's older than the World Bank, it's the first place to start organizing global bailouts. It helped bail out Spain and Austria and Hungary in the 1930s.
Wow.
You ever wondered, I mean, you know, you must have wondered, how did we get to this place where these guys in suits can just kind of jet into a country and start telling it what to do?
Yeah.
Tell sovereign governments what to do. Well, that all started at the BIS. you know, during the Second World War, the BIS was the secret, you know, the place for secret contact between both sides, even though they were fighting to keep the financial channels open. In the decades after the Second World War, the BIS, something we haven't talked about, but in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, the BIS was the place where all the planning and a lot of technical work was done for the introduction of the euro. And the European Central Bank, which controls monetary policy for the Eurozone, 17 countries, was originally a satellite of the BIS. It started at the BIS, something called the European Monetary Institute. So nowadays, the BIS does host, I mean, there is a meeting place, the review is correcting that, as I said before, host the Global Economy Meeting, but also host the Financial Stability Board. It hosts the Banking Committee on the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, which runs, as I said, commercial banks, not central banks,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you and I have our money.
Sure.
So I think the BIS is much, much more than just a meeting place.
Mm-hmm. Fair.
So that's my reply.
Yeah, and I think it's a good one.
It is. So, Adam, what was I going to add? Oh, Adam, what, you have a website and so forth that people can follow some of your information. Where would that be?
Yeah, it's just my name, AdamLebor, AdamLebor.com.
AdamLebor.com. That's great.
Yeah,
and
I'm on Twitter as well, at, you know, just my name, AdamLebor.
Oh, great. I'll be following you in a matter of moments.
Twitter yet.
Yeah, I know you haven't.
I have no idea why anybody Twitters. But anyway, that's not the
people
importance
don't Twitter,
of this.
Drew. They tweet.
And whatever, I don't care. It's
clarifying for me, that's all.
But it's what was the other thing? Oh, I know what it was. You have some ideas of what the Bank for International Settlement should do in the sense of transparency and charity, et cetera, et cetera. So why don't you tell us some of those ideas?
Yeah, I think the BIS is obviously not going away. It's protected by an international treaty. It's enormously profitable, and it's got a lot of very powerful friends, so it's here to stay. But I think it's, you know, it's got to adapt to the 21st century. Its setup is, you know, essentially not very different from 1930, and the world has moved on since 1930. So I think, firstly, there should be some kind of minutes released of the global economy meetings and the discussions that take place there. Now, they don't have to be completely detailed because, obviously, it's, you know, that's okay for central bankers to meet and have confidential discussions. But we need, you know, there's a happy medium between no information and all the information, and I think they need to take a step towards releasing some of it. I think also the bank needs to bear in mind much more that, you know, this is public money that is going into the BIS and churning out these profits. This is, you know, money from central banks, which are the central banks of nations,
mm-hmm.
and central bankers are public servants. So I think that they should issue a large tranche of shares to, you know, what we call civil society or non-governmental organizations, to bring them into the bank to have a say in its work and to open it up and make it more transparent. And I also think that the BIS should set up some kind of trust, you know, maybe a bit like George Soros did with his Open Society Institute, to train bankers and to, you know, bring people in to learn much more. Now, I put this to them and they say, look, we do actually have a lot of training for central bankers each, you know, every year. We have all these seminars and everything like that that people can come to. So they have made some steps towards that. But
you're telling them to put their money where their mouth is.
Yeah. You do that, guys. That's exactly it.
Hey, Adam, we're only got like a minute to go. And if I'm not mistaken, Brad Thor, who has made some prescient calls of some scandals, I think he's made at least two in the last 3 or 4 years, as some things that he said in a year or two before they happened, and they actually happened. And if I'm not mistaken, it was Brad Thor who just recently, like within the last 6 months or so, has said the next scandal is coming out of the Federal Reserve and some of these central banks, that the public's going to find out what it's all about and some of the unbelievable behavior that goes on in these places. What say you in the minute we have left?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I don't think that I can, you know, sit here and say that there's some huge scandal waiting to explode in the Federal Reserve. I would make a broader point, you know, just about transparency, that, you know, all, wherever there's money and wherever there's opaque institutions, we need more information about what's going on. But I've got to say, the Federal Reserve is not bad compared to the BIS. You know, you can look on the Federal Reserve website and it will tell you who goes to the meetings every couple of months, tells you where they are all day, each day that they're there, what time they arrive, and what room they're going to be in. So the Federal Reserve is definitely some way ahead of the BIS in terms of transparency.
Very impressive for a guy who's up at 1 a.m. in the morning his time, Drew. I'd be incoherent. You'd be...
He's talking about it. He likes being in the town of
Pest.
He's just going out to the bars tonight.
Well, have one for me.
Yeah. I usually am more incoherent by 1 o'clock in the morning. But not tonight.
Adam, we really appreciate it. In your book, Tower of Basel, and we suggest everyone read it and understand the history of central banking. Anyway, this is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.
Thank you.